We've been asking what made the 15th century in England and Wales a period of repeated violence, or at least the years between 1459 and 1485. Now, traditionally, it was explained as the Wars of the Roses, but we've seen that that just won't do. There's no evidence of a sustained feud between Red Rose Lancastrian nobles and the White Rose Yorkists. Even the roses weren't invented until later.
What we've been discovering instead is that there's something unusual about the nobility in this period. It was less numerous than before and more interrelated. Since about 1385, its titles, Duke, Earl and all the rest, had been hereditary. It meant that the nobility had become a tight, proud, quarrelsome bunch, often openly fighting amongst themselves.
The problem for the monarch was to bring order to this unruly collection of powerful men. It's good to see you at the History Cafe. Thanks for joining us. This is where we come to give a new take on history. We revisit well-known stories that have got stuck in our collective memory, but just don't look right anymore. I'm Penelope Middlebow.
And I'm John Rosebank, and I suppose we have the best job in the world.
I think we do.
We take the latest research and we ask the questions that nobody else seems to, and we put it all into stories everyone can enjoy. So find yourself a coffee, pull up a chair, and let's see where we end up.
The striking thing about the 15th century is that it has for many generations been regarded by historians as the end of medieval England and Wales and the beginning of the modern. Something profound was changing for that to be so, but what was it?
Well, the best clue we've been able to find so far is that the nobility was very different from before. Successive monarchs were unable to contain the nobles' quarrelsome behaviour, the so-called Wars of the Roses, which we've been discovering were not wars at all and had nothing whatever to do with roses until they were over.
So why couldn't 15th century English monarchs keep their nobility in order? Was it just because there was a succession of weak kings, inutiles, useless, as contemporaries put it, or under mighty kings, as the modern historian of the period, Kenneth MacFarlane, described them? The answer is, as we saw last time, yes, and also no. There was also a bigger problem.
Well, the tried and tested way to keep nobles out of trouble was to go to war. Not because it offered the landowners a bit of adventure and glory, though perhaps for some of them that mattered, nor because it got the wealthy landowners out from under the king's feet, though that must also have helped. Nor just because, as we heard in Shakespeare's famous version of the Battle of Agincourt last time, it drew the king and nobility together as a band of brothers. No, going to war was mainly a success, if at any rate you won, because it offered everyone the chance to make a great deal of money.
15th century warfare was certainly about killing people, but it was much more about capturing them and then selling them for a ransom. There was a really healthy black market in selling hostages on and eventually extracting large sums from their families for their return. Lord Fanhope, for example, bought a job lot of French prisoners from the Earl of Norfolk in 1421, and made so much money from selling them on that he built an entire new castle at Ampthill.
Yeah, it was later one of Henry VIII's favourite palaces. You won't discover how it was paid for, however, on the Royal Palace's website. All those hostages. Well, the going rate for a ransom was about a year's worth of the hostages' income, but it could be much more. Lord Mullins was ransomed for £6,000, an enormous sum, perhaps about £6 million today, in 1453. But he then had to pay a further £3,800 for the expense of imprisoning him. Finally got out in 1459, 6 years later. Sieges were another way to make money, since many were ended not when one side or the other won, but when the besieged castle or town bought the besiegers off. In 1428, the French garrison at Laval paid Lord Talbot £3,000 just to go away.
Going to war was an economically attractive proposition, especially if you needed to satisfy a greedy nobility. This was the solution adopted by Henry V, who invaded Normandy in 1413 and famously defeated the French 2 years later in October 1415 at the Battle of Agincourt. That battle is remembered for the English and Welsh longbowmen who brilliantly outshot their French enemies. And also, of course, because Shakespeare wrote it into his play on Henry V and gave us once more into the breach, dear friends, once more.
Yeah, and we happy few, band of brothers.
And other lines we've all heard and can't quite remember.
Henry V was a brilliantly successful, or lucky, military commander, helped perhaps by the fact that his opponent, the French king, Charles VI, was suffering bouts of mental illness, in which, in fact, he believed he was made of glass. Agincourt was really important, however, because it led on to the successful conquest of Normandy. And that provided not only plenty of opportunities for wonderful ransom, but also for employing large numbers of the nobility, or more particularly their poorer dependents, who could administer all the newly conquered territory.
The historian Kenneth MacFarlane once came across an agreement between two of Henry V's soldiers, Nicholas Molyneux and John Winter. It was signed on Saturday, the 12th of July, 1421, in the Church of St. Martin at Harfleur on the Normandy coast.
Yes, that part of Le Havre, in fact.
If you can't get there, go to the Tate, where there's a beautiful painting of the church and the town by Turner.
Well, the agreement signed by Molyneux and Winter set out that if either were taken prisoner, which, quotes, God forbid, the other was bound to do everything possible to secure his freedom, providing that the ransom the other side demanded didn't exceed £1,000.
Million.
About a million today, yeah. If it did, well, then the free brother-in-arms would submit himself as a hostage, so that the captive could go home and raise the money.
Sounds a good deal for the one who goes home.
Yeah, should both be captured at the same time, one would stay as a hostage while the other tried to fund the ransom for them both. There's a whole world of medieval hostage negotiation to be discovered here.
The two soldiers also agreed to pool any profits they might make in France, this is interesting, with various arrangements for dividing it up. And if either of them was killed, for using it to care for any future wives and children. They really were thinking ahead. MacFarlane guessed that in 1421, these two men can't have been the humblest kind of foot soldiers. But when they signed the agreement on the Normandy coast, they were probably still young, unmarried, with enough cash to buy some basic military equipment and not much more.
But it is a rare insight into 15th century war. This was all about money. And it's especially interesting because MacFarlane was able to discover what happened to the two young soldiers, Molyneux and Winter, next.
Time to meet Joan of Arc. The best way in the 15th century to keep your landowners and nobility contented was to go to war. It was a means to quick profits.
So long, of course, as you weren't captured or killed.
Sensible soldiers teamed up and signed agreements to support each other if they were taken hostage or worse. The historian Kenneth MacFarlane found one such agreement, signed by two young soldiers, Nicholas Molyneux and John Winter, in the summer of 1421. They joined Henry V's invasion of Normandy. They were starting out with very little, but they clearly had high hopes of making huge profits.
MacFarlane then discovered that Thomas Winter ended up working for Sir John Fastolf, a landowner who became one of Henry V's military commanders. Now, Fastolf indeed made a fortune fighting in France, acquiring a reputation as, quotes, cruel and vengeable. What a wonderful word, vengeable. And making himself one of the richest men in England.
Shakespeare, for some reason, borrowed his name for the very different character, Sir John Falstaff, in Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Well, anyway, among other jobs the soldier John Winter did for the real-life John Falstaff was to become some kind of debt collector in France. Well, when Winter died in 1445, he left hundreds of acres and a whole series of properties that he bought in what's now the Brixton area of South London. Going to war had indeed proved very profitable for him.
His soldier mate, Nicholas Molyneux, did even better. He became the cruel and vengeable Fastolf's receiver general, in charge of all his finances in France. He seems to have done the same job also for the Dukes of Bedford and York.
Yeah, Bedford, incidentally, was a Lancastrian, and York, well, he was obviously a Yorkist. Yeah. So as we've been saying, nobody at the time took any notice of any of that Lancaster and York business. You could work for both of them at the same time.
Eventually, Nicholas Molyneux became a senior official in the English royal administration in France, and of course ended up buying swathes of land in England, as well as inheriting much of Winters, who'd now died. By the 1440s, Fastolf was talking about Molyneux as his right well-beloved brother. It was just 20 years since that simple contract signed in that Normandy church. Nicholas Molyneux had come a very long way indeed.
But when Molyneux died, sometime in the mid-1450s, he was apparently deeply in debt. And almost certainly the key to his problems was the collapse of the English Empire in France. You see, just over a year after Molyneux and Winter signed their contract, Henry V was struck down with some kind of serious illness. Probably not dysentery, as it was always thought, but something serious enough to kill him. He died at Vincennes. He was just 35, and he left his kingdoms to his baby son, Henry VI. Now, 6 years after that, a 16-year-old peasant girl turned up at the French court, claiming to see visions that would guide the French to victory against the English. Well, the French king, Charles VII, son of the one who thought he was made of glass, was so convinced, or perhaps so desperate, that he packed the girl off to join his army, which was at that time being besieged by the English at Orléans. Just 9 days after she arrived, the English abandoned the siege without even being bought off.
They just ran away.
In fact, after a series of victories, Joan of Arc found herself standing by Charles VII at his coronation as King of France.
It's a wonderful story, but sadly, Joan of Arc's career lasted just a few days over 2 years. After the coronation, there was a string of French defeats. In 1430, Joan was captured at the siege of Compiègne and handed over to the English.
Or no doubt sold for a very great deal of money.
The English, of course, famously burned her at the stake. The French still regard Jeanne d'Arc as their patron saint. It may well be that her visions inspired the French commanders, who now began successfully pushing the English out of France. But in truth, the English were already in trouble. Henry V had left his kingdom to his baby son, Henry VI, who was only 9 months old. Without their swashbuckling leader, with or without his stirring Shakespearean soliloquies, the English began to fall apart.
Thomas Winter and Nicholas Molyneux's initial rise to fortune in the 1420s and 1430s shows that the English Empire in France didn't immediately collapse. But from the mid-1430s, Sir John Fastolf, that's Molyneux and Winter's ruthless boss, could see the way in which the wind was blowing. He began selling off his French lands. Well, the end came finally in 1450 when the English lost all their northern French lands except Calais. In 1453, the English also lost all their remaining lands, which were in Gascony in southwest France, which they'd held since the 1150s.
It was when he was told of this new disaster that Henry V's son, Henry VI, by now 32, suffered a complete collapse and was unable, as we saw in an earlier discussion, for months to speak or act. It was said he could barely rouse himself even to respond to the birth of his first and only child, Edward, 6 months into the illness.
Well, it used to be said that these defeats forced thousands of penniless soldiers back to England, and that this was the real cause of the Wars of the Roses. But, well, look, that's a tale that's always told after wars. It was told also after the Napoleonic Wars, and there's very little evidence that it was ever quite like that. Ordinary soldiers have been drifting steadily backwards and forwards over the years. And if they now became a pool of military experience ready for action, it would take a good deal more than fine speeches to persuade them back into some Earl's army for a bit of skirmishing. Both in towns and on the land, there was high demand for labour. Wages were attractive. The chances of making money out of a few ragged battles in England were much less than in an invasion of France. And as we shall see, landlords were now much less able to order their tenants to turn out and fight than they had been in the past.
It also used to be suggested that losing the French lands seriously compromised royal finances. Without some income from France, English kings were just too poor to rule and keep their country in order. But we now know that keeping an army and an administration in France had long cost the English crown heavily. In fact, it was the war itself that had left the royal treasury virtually bankrupt by the 1450s. The real problem caused by the English defeat in France was that the English landowners and nobility no longer had access to the steady stream of cash that had kept them in the style to which they had grown accustomed. Not only was there no money in the royal coffers, but there were no longer profitable jobs in France. And above all, no more black market in ransom of hostages.
By now, as we've seen, these landowners were a small, interrelated and bickering group, cooped up in England, with an agricultural depression settling in. It would have been no surprise at all if these landed families now resorted to what the historian Michael Poston long ago famously called political gangsterdom. Well, that's too simple an explanation on its own, but it contains a grain of historical truth. The point is that without a war to offer them, it was far more difficult for the monarchy to control this surly knot of nobles, and it's the failure of the solutions they now tried that go a long way to explaining the violence that broke out.
After 1453, the English King Henry VI didn't have a French war to occupy and enrich his nobility. So what alternative did he have?
Well, one proven solution was to get the nobles to court and give them jobs there. Wasn't going to make anyone particularly rich, but it was a way to offer status and a stake in upholding the peace and stability of the kingdom. And also to have the nobility where you could keep an eye on them. But if this was your strategy, you had to pull off an almost impossible balancing act. You had to get all the various feuding factions to work together and then get them on your side.
Now, while Henry VI had been too young to rule, remember he was only 9 months old when his father Henry V had died in 1422, the council had governed in his place, and they had managed to keep the peace at court with some success. But then, it was easier, because until the early 1440s, there were still lands and jobs in France to keep the nobility profitably busy. After 1445, however, things started to go quickly downhill.
Well, that was the year that Henry VI married Margaret of Anjou. In fact, it was part of a deal with the French, an attempt to stop their advancing military. Unusually for a royal bride, Margaret brought virtually nothing with her, unless you count the islands of Majorca and Menorca,
which her family claimed.
But which, in fact, owned by somebody else, by the Aragonese by that time. Anyway, she was, as we've seen in our previous discussions, a bullish character, more than willing to take the English nobility on. The problem was that marrying Margaret of Anjou encouraged Henry VI, who was now, after all, 24, to push the council aside and start, at last, to rule for himself.
Which was not a good thing, because the man was just not capable of good government. He may, as some said at the time, have been a dreamer. He may, as most historians believe, have suffered from some mental illness. But encouraged by his forceful new French wife, Margaret of Anjou, Henry now tried to take control. The result was chaos. During 1447 to 48, Henry only spent 20% of his time in or near London. Mostly, he was far away, effectively out of contact in Durham or Glastonbury.
Well, as we can now see, this was a complete disaster. As historian John Watts has shown, the nobles now began staying away from court. And this is the key to the chaos that followed. Government became more and more concentrated in the hands of a small and unrepresentative clique around the Queen and the Duke of Suffolk, who'd been Henry's main counsellor since the early 1440s and had in fact originally negotiated the marriage with Margaret of Anjou. The historian Ralph Griffiths has shown, in fact, that Suffolk was blatantly abusing his position around the king to create his own private empire, trading in wardships, lands, pardons, even commercial privileges. Well, if you're trying to keep the many feuding factions of nobility on your side, this is the very last thing you want to happen.
And criticism of Suffolk was clearly countrywide, because remember, he was toppled in 1449 and murdered by sailors at Dover.
You remember, welcome traitor, they dragged him aboard.
Yes, and they didn't recognise his letter of safe conduct from the king.
The only crown we recognise is the community.
But the problem of finding good government didn't go away. Anjou continued, after Suffolk's demise, to attempt to rule through a small clique loyal to herself. It was the opposite of what was needed from a 15th century monarchy, with a collection of difficult nobles to keep on side.
But of course, opposition to Anjou eventually coalesced around Richard, Duke of York. It was not because he was claiming the throne for the Yorkists, because he wasn't doing that at all. It was because he was the country's greatest landowner and one of its most experienced and respected administrators. But Anjou, in order to protect her own position, and maybe her own little clique, had been determined from the start to exclude York from the king's council.
Now the struggle between York and Anjou in the course of the 1450s is just too confused and complicated to go through here.
Yeah, there are lots of very good books about it by very fine historians. They're easy to find because they're all of them called The Wars of the Roses. You can find them on our website.
You could try Christine Carpenter's classic account.
Yeah, it's very good.
Called The Wars of the Roses. In May 1455, there was something very close to an open battle at St Albans, when York's men killed the king's new chief minister, the Duke of Somerset.
Yeah, meaning Anjou's new chief minister, in fact.
And the king's treasurer.
Yeah, well, Anjou's treasurer, maybe.
And Anjou's treasurer only escaped by disguising himself as a monk. Anjou then persuaded her husband, Henry, to remove the Duke of York completely from his council.
And then she took King Henry and her son and retreated to the Midlands, where most of her supporters were based. Well, what happened next is controversial among historians, but it seems that in November 1459, she or her noble supporters convinced a parliament meeting in Coventry to strip the Duke of York of all his lands. Anjou now began using her supporters' local contacts to raise an army. Significantly, it would wear not the king's insignia, but a swan, that of their baby son. Contemporaries, in fact, described it as the Queen's army. Henry himself was now asleep much of the time, or hidden away in a monastery.
Well, on the 10th of October 1460, York finally called for an end to all this nonsense. In fact, he called for Parliament to rid the kingdom of the incapable King Henry VI once and for all. The answer York proposed would be to make him king in Henry's place. It was an extreme solution, and York justified it by finally making the claim, which the York family had so far always avoided making, at least in public, that the Lancastrians had never been legitimate kings of England. They'd usurped the throne in 1399 when Henry IV had imprisoned and starved to death the Yorkist King Richard II. If that was true, then he, Richard Duke of York, was now the true heir to the throne, the true king of England and Wales.
Well, Parliament was horrified. It was true that, as we've seen during these years, a number of people, including the leading judge John Fortescue, had discussed the question of replacing Henry, and Richard Duke of York was the obvious candidate, since many agreed that he did indeed have a very strong family claim to the throne. He was descended from not one, but two of Richard II's uncles. But much more important, Richard Duke of York would be capable of running the country. Problem was, everyone had sworn solemn oaths of loyalty to Henry VI, and breaking them in the 15th century meant going to hell.
The House of Lords came up with a compromise. Henry VI would remain as king for his lifetime, but, and this was the key part, the Duke of York would effectively rule as Lord Protector. When Henry died, it would be York and not Henry's own son, or Margaret's own son, who would become king. In fact, York was older than Henry and was more likely to die first, but after Henry, it would be York's children who would inherit the throne.
This wasn't about competing dynasties. It was about finding a way to cut the French Queen Margaret of Anjou and her son and her favourites out of government. At last, it would broaden the base of government to reflect something more like the real balance of power among the nobles in the country. After 15 years of chaos, England could get back to a government everyone could believe in. Far from pressing his own immediate claim to the throne, the Duke of York accepted the deal straight away. He would be Lord Protector.
So what did the Queen do? She, of course, refused. She proposed instead giving the throne directly that minute to her six-year-old son. Now, with York as protector, it would have made little difference. But Anjou insisted on being made protector herself. This went to the heart of the problem. It wasn't the Lancastrians that Parliament and the nobles objected to. It was Margaret. Parliament turned her down.
Well, her response was to take her son and flee in search of foreign support. By the time they reached Wales, they had only four servants left. Anjou appealed to the King of Scotland for help. Well, to be more exact, his advisor, since the King of Scotland was only 9 years old. She offered to give them the town of Berwick if Scotland joined her side. Like it was hers, kind. Hers to give away. Amazingly, by December 1460, she had scraped an army together. Her captains, remembering she was French, proclaimed her the new Joan of Arc.
The problem that lay at the heart of English government in the 15th century was winning and then keeping the loyalty of an increasingly small and quarrelsome nobility. Henry V had solved the problem by going to war in France. But Henry V was dead, and in 1453 the French had finally thrown the English out of France, except for a small patch of land around Calais. Containing the English nobility now became a pressing problem.
It was made much worse by the incapacity of Henry VI. It was made almost insoluble by the ineptitude of his queen, Margaret of Anjou, who attempted to govern the country herself, not with a balanced council of the nobility, but through a small and unrepresentative, not to mention corrupt, clique of her favourites. By the end of 1460, the country's leading landowner, Richard of York, had in desperation finally thrown Queen Margaret out and persuaded Parliament to name him as Protector, effectively king on Henry VI's behalf. It was a traditional English constitutional solution to the problem. Margaret fled north and, with Scottish help, raised an army.
It was effectively a Scottish invasion. The Duke of York, the Lord Protector of England and Wales, now marched north to confront it. So in December 1460, there were two rival armies in the field, something we might now at last call the Wars of the Roses. But this wasn't, in fact, as we've said, Yorkists against Lancastrians. It was the Duke of York against the French Queen Margaret of Anjou.
Or it was the English against the Scots, if you like. On the 30th of December 1460, Richard of York was holed up in his castle near Wakefield. That day he rode out, probably to forage for food. Later, his supporters would claim that a truce had been agreed with the other side. Well, whether it was or not, he found himself surrounded by the Queen's army. Now, in most medieval battles, as we've seen, you might kill the ordinary soldiers, but you captured the nobles. You stole their valuable horses, their armour and their jewels, and then you ransomed them for profit. Well, at Wakefield, it was the other way round. They let the soldiers go. But the Duke of York died fighting. His younger son, just 17, was killed trying to escape.
The Queen's army now marched south. It was winter, there was little food, and her troops pilfered and pillaged to survive. The Earl of Warwick, who had been Richard of York's closest ally and was himself one of the most influential of the nobles, took King Henry VI and marched with an army to confront the Queen. He would force the Queen to fight the King and commit open treason.
On the 17th of February 1461, the two armies met at St Albans, where in fact there had been a battle 6 years before, you remember. Warwick's army included a force of Burgundian mercenaries who brought all the latest weaponry with them. Shocking new devices that, quote, would shoot pellets of lead.
Guns?
Yeah, guns. As well as nets and shields studded with nails. But it did them no good at all. The Queen's northerners defeated Warwick, and he was lucky to escape. According to one French witness, the Queen's army then found Henry under a tree a mile away, laughing and singing to himself.
But that was as far as the Queen got. The terrified Londoners, who'd never liked the Queen, hearing rumours of the Queen's soldiers actually looting, refused to open their gates. Margaret of Anjou returned to her Midland strongholds, making sure to take her husband with her this time.
Well, after the murder of the Duke of York and his 17-year-old son, his eldest surviving son, Edward, inherited his title as Duke of York. Edward now joined forces with Warwick. On the 26th of February 1461, they reached London and on the 2nd of March proclaimed Edward as King of England.
And the Londoners loved it.
2 days later, Edward processed to Westminster. He put on the royal robes and went into Westminster Abbey. And there he was presented with St Edward's sceptre. It was a coronation. He sat in the coronation chair and the choir sang the Te Deum. England had two kings. As we saw last time, this had nothing to do with his dynastic right to the throne. People at the time, quote, full of indignation, simply said that Henry was a useless king, rex inutilis, and that Edward had been elected, chosen in his place.
King Edward IV now raised an army and marched north, and the two sides of the two kings met near York. It was Palm Sunday, the 29th of March, 1461, and there may have been as many as 50,000 men on the battlefield, perhaps even more. Skirmishes broke out before dawn as the advance guards of the two armies scouted and fought for key river bridges and high positions. As day broke, the Queen's army, a third larger than York's, had taken up a strong position on high ground near the village of Towton, with marshy ground and rivers on three sides. The Queen had remained in York with the King, Henry VI, and her son.
Now, archaeologists have reconstructed much of the Battle of Towton from arrowheads and other weapons that they've been able to dig up. At first, it seems, the Queen's army had most of the advantages. But a strong wind was blowing in their faces, and in a battle where bows and arrows are key, that's very serious. The Yorkists approached, led by King Edward IV, head and shoulders taller than most men on the battlefield. He was nearly 2 metres high. His standard was carried by distinguished Welsh knight, David Ap Matthew.
Even taller.
He was even taller.
6 foot 8.
6 foot 8. By now a gale was blowing up, driving sleet and snow into his enemy's eyes.
Edward IV's army fought up and onto the high ground from where their arrows would carry much further. Anjou's army was now shooting blind into the snow, their arrows falling short. They began falling back, their lines beginning to twist under the attack.
The Duke of Norfolk had been far behind Edward, bringing up his heavy army wagons. He didn't reach the fighting until early in the afternoon. But then he crashed into the side of Anjou's army with 5,000 fresh men. The battle became a grim hand-to-hand slug. It's said that the Earl of Warwick dismounted, killed his horse, kissed his sword, and swore he'd defend King Edward to the end.
As the grey light began to drain, the Anjou line broke, and the Queen's soldiers found themselves caught in the trap they'd set for Edward's army. There was nowhere to run except through the marshes and across the rivers.
Well, many men drowned, so many it said that they were scrambling across the water on the dead bodies of their fellow soldiers. In his battles, Edward had always called, as was normal at that time, for ordinary soldiers to be spared. But this time he called for no quarter.
A pit was discovered in 1996 where hundreds of Anjou's archers were buried. They'd been clubbed to death, probably with their hands tied. Archaeologists reckon some of them had had their ears cut off.
Historians usually write that Towton was the longest and cruelest battle in English history. Edward IV always claimed that 28,000 men died that day. Well, we don't have to accept his boast. Archaeologists reckon the figure was nearer 3,000, which was much more like other battles of the time. Even so, Edward had massacred his enemies. Three quarters of the, well, few existing English nobles had fought in the battle, most of them, in fact, on the Queen's side. 42 of her knights were captured and executed. Many others ended up in exile. After the battle, Queen Margaret fled back to Scotland, this time taking Henry and her son with them. Oh yes, and also Henry's servant, Sir Richard Tunstall, who we've heard about before, who may or may not have been the boy's real father.
Much later, people said that white roses, tinged with red, grew on the battlefield at Towton. Of course, neither side in 1461 had used a rose as their emblem. What had been a long struggle to govern the English and Welsh nobility, despite an incapable king and a politically foolish foreign queen, had just, for a moment, resolved itself into a violent clash between rival kings, Henry of Lancaster and Edward of York. But the claims of rival dynasties had never been the real issue. And it had been mercifully brief. It hadn't lasted 86 years, from 1399 to 1485, as traditional accounts of the Wars of the Roses used to say. It had, in fact, lasted less than 4 months, from December 1460 to March 1461. And that was that.
Well, it should have been. Edward of York, who was now Edward IV, faced exactly the same problem as his predecessors. How did you govern an unruly and divided nobility? Back to square one. The task should have been easier than it had been, since so many of them had been killed in the fighting at Towton.
But then Edward IV made a catastrophic mistake. He got married, as we shall see next time at the History Cafe.
There are nearly 100 podcasts at the History Cafe, all of them still as new as the day they were recorded. Go to our website, historycafe.org, and you can get a rundown on the research we've done and plenty of leads to follow if you still want more.
You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every other platform you can think of. Just look out for History Cafe Podcast with John and Penelope. If it's your thing, follow us on Instagram and what used to be Twitter at History Cafe Pod. And ask your friends to join us too.